This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Amanda Brunson, Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Louisiana. We'll talk about corporal punishment and whether it should be a thing of the past and what's going on with the NFL and Adrian Peterson. Also on the show, we'll hear from Donna Dee. She's to be inducted in the Manship School of Mass Communication Hall of Fame tonight, the organizer of the Million Mom March, and she's associated with some big people in the media world, including David Letterman and Rex Reed. And Casey Yoder, who was involved in Louisiana in the labor movement and is taking aim at Walmart and the firing of the PR director for falsifying his resume. And we'll hear from Thomas Cahill. His book is Heretics and Heroes. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside this area, call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and we begin with Amanda Brunson. She is Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Louisiana. She's held that position for 5 years and has worked with this organization for 11 years. Her organization and many others around the country have been called upon of late because of the controversy swirling about Adrian Peterson, one of the NFL's premier players, indicted. And in yesterday's New York Times, Michael Eric Dyson, a African-American professor of sociology at Georgetown, he writes, "The indictment of the NFL player Adrian Peterson by a Texas grand jury for reckless or negligent injury to a child has set into relief the harmful disciplinary practices of some black families. Mr. Peterson used a switch, a slim, leafless tree branch, to beat his 4-year-old son, raising welts on the youngster's legs, buttocks, and scrotum. This is child abuse dressed up as acceptable punishment," writes Mr. Dyson. 297-5633, if you'd like to chime in. Amanda Brunson, is this child abuse?
It is. And first off, Jim, thank you for having me here this morning. Thankfully, this situation has opened up the dialogue across the country on parenting and what is appropriate discipline. And I think that so many families parent the way that they were parented. That's all you have to pull from. You know, that's all you know. And that's exactly what Peterson said he did, that this is what his parents did to him. And so this is an opportunity for all parents all across the country, black, white, you know, regardless of their socioeconomic level, to really stop and take a look at their parenting practices and what other alternatives exist to them that maybe they haven't tried before.
This is excessive. I think almost everyone would agree, but others say, look, it's one thing to open welts on a kid, but it's another thing to whip a boy or a girl on the behind if they act up and not physically injure them. You don't like that either.
Well, as an organization, we don't promote or condone any type of physical punishment. And really, that is because it's hard to define that line between physical discipline and child abuse. And it's pretty impossible for a parent to know or be able to measure the force that they're hitting with or the impact that it will have on the child. And the legal definition of child abuse in Louisiana is the infliction, attempted infliction, or as a result of inadequate supervision, the allowance of infliction or attempted affliction of physical or mental injury to the child. So that's a pretty broad definition. And mm-hmm. So I think it's really hard for a parent to figure out where that line is and how to stay within it.
Michael Eric Dyson in yesterday's New York Times says, while 70% of Americans approve of corporal punishment, that's 70% approving, black Americans have a distinct history with the subject. Beating children has been a depressingly familiar habit in black families since our arrival in the New World, writes Mr. Dyson. Now, his words were echoed in a big way by Charles Barkley, the great basketball player from Auburn University who played many years in the NBA. He was interviewed by Jim Rome, and Frank, I think we have a snippet of Charles Barkley.
right is right and wrong is wrong. No matter where you're from.
I don't believe that because, listen, we spank kids in the South. I think the question about did Adrian Peterson go overboard? But listen, Jim, we all grew up in different environments. Listen, every black parent in my neighborhood in the South would be in trouble or in jail under those circumstances.
Listen, my thing is, I don't want to tell anybody how to raise their kids, and I really don't want anybody telling me how to raise my kids. Uh-huh. But let's make a distinction between child rearing and child abuse.
And that's a very...
That was child abuse. There's no fine line here.
I think there's a fine line. Jim, I've had many welts on my legs in last
welts
week.
Like that?
Oh, yeah. I've got beat with switches. And I hate to use... First of all, I don't even like the term. You know, when the media talks about it, and somebody just said something on television, beating a child... Listen, we don't...
But that's what that was, though, Chuck. Yeah, you saw the pictures.
Well, we call it spanking or whipping our kids.
I see open wounds and bruises throughout a body, that is a beating.
Sure. I think those pictures are disturbing. Maybe.
All right, that's Charles Barkley, who says he was beaten as a child. And there's the old axioms, spare the rod, spoil the child. Dr. Spock changed all that. But I must say, Amanda, I know a lot of people and... Some of the best adjusted people I know, like Mr. Barkley, have been whipped as a kid, and some of the least well-adjusted people were not spanked when they did things wrong. So should this be a parental decision, or should it be the decision of the federal and state government as to whether a crime is committed when somebody is disciplining their child?
Well, it should always be a parental decision. I think parents have a right to raise their children the way that they see fit, and all parents, really, truly, they want to be good parents, and they want to convey their morals and values to their kids. The goal for all of us is that hopefully our children become responsible, productive members of society as an adult. And so the other thing I think we need to remember is that historically, when we know better, we do better. When we realize that seatbelts save lives, then we started to put them in all cars and we all buckled up. And same goes for smoking. When we realized how dangerous that was, we made changes as a society. And so research continues to come out and tell us that spanking is maybe not as effective as we thought it was. And I think there's also... this disconnect where a lot of people assume that because you may choose not to spank your children, that means an absence of discipline. And that absolutely does not have to be the case. Children need limits. They need boundaries. They need direction. But there may be more effective ways to do that where you can really communicate what is acceptable and what is appropriate.
And quite often you deal with those who are obviously committing crimes, injuring children, some cases killing them. How often does this happen?
Well, Louisiana ranks 47th in the nation in overall child well-being. We have around 10,000 validated victims of child abuse and neglect every year. But the beautiful thing about our organization is that we're focused on prevention, on primary prevention of child abuse and neglect, which means stopping abuse and neglect before it ever occurs. So while discipline is on the fringe of what we do kind of all year round, it's really about just making sure that parents are supported and that they're able to meet the needs of their children because they've been able to deal with maybe substance abuse or economic situations, you know, anything that may cause parental stress and prohibit them from being able to appropriately care for their kids, we work to mediate that.
What are some alternative methods of discipline?
Well, one is loss of a privilege, you know, whether it's time with a friend or it's electronics, gadgets, you know, TV time. So, number one, you have to communicate with your kids what the rules are and what the expectations are ahead of time so that they know exactly where their boundaries lie, and then you're able to intervene and to offer a penalty if it's warranted.
Freeman and Lafayette, good morning, Freeman. You're on with Amanda Brunson, the Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Louisiana, and please turn down your radio, Freeman. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. I just want to make a quick comment, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. First of all, I disagree with Mr. Barkley, and the reason why I disagree with him is there is a bigger line between abuse and discipline. I grew up in South Mississippi, and one of the things that a lot of African-American parents told us growing up is that you need to be disciplined this way because you have to understand you're young, you're African-American, you'll be the first one to be arrested. I need to discipline you at home before your arrest. In other words, I'm going to get you before the white man gets you. That was the big thing. And so we were sent out for our own switches. Sometimes, you know, they left marks, but very few of us got in trouble. Nowadays, it's illegal to really put your hands on your children, and it's made it more difficult for African Americans to discipline their kids. And when you look at the amount of people that's in jail that are African Americans, especially in Louisiana, you can see some of the results. And I think that again, there is a line between discipline and abuse. And I think, with the player at the NFL, he went overboard. There's no doubt about that. Thank you.
All right. Interesting remarks from Freeman, obviously sincere about this, and I think most people are. And Adrian Peterson, one of the greatest players in the history of the league, may never play again. He's not going to play this Sunday. And there's a stigma in our country toward child abuse, as there should be, that goes beyond just about anything else. If you're a child abuser, you're really the scum of the earth. But is it, when we get right down to it, is it abuse if you spank your child? If that's the case, then my parents abused me, and I don't think they did.
Well, and I think even the state of Louisiana, our child welfare office will tell you that it is not illegal in Louisiana to spank your children. And by the term spanking, there are so many different interpretations of that. Some people interpret it as an open hand on a bottom. Some people interpret it as a switch or as a wooden spoon. And so it's very difficult to have clear conversations about where does that line lie and spanking versus beating and child abuse versus discipline. But the real goal of discipline, the root of the word discipline, the Latin root, is about teaching and guiding. And so we really have to look at what are our goals as a parent and are there ways that we can really help our children get to where we want them to be that don't include violence.
Mm-hmm. You have how many children?
I have three.
Three? Boys and girls?
I have one boy and two girls.
Do you spank them?
I do not.
You do not. Would it be different to spank your son as opposed to spanking your daughters?
I can't imagine, honestly, my kids experiencing my hand in that way. And I'll say, as a parent of young children, we're around lots of families of young children, and it can be very frustrating to be around kids who have no discipline and parents who are very permissive and let their kids kind of do whatever they want. So absolutely, kids need discipline. Kids need boundaries. It's just a matter of what are the options out there for you as a parent.
All right. Tell us about KidLine.
KidLine is a parent helpline. It's here in Louisiana from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. The number's 1-800-CHILDREN. And it's a line where parents can call anonymously, confidentially, and just receive parenting education, parent support, kind of tips on whatever they're going through. And I think one thing that's come up with this Peterson case, too, is that clearly, regardless of your socioeconomic status, regardless of your situation in life, parenting is stressful. You know, we all experience those moments with our kids where before we even walk out the door to work, we're ready to pull our hair out. And so KidLine is there as a resource to just kind of talk through where you can go, what your options are for parenting, maybe how to handle potty training or an out-of-control teenager, and then also connections to community resources. So if you need, you know, food stamps or counseling or whatever that may be, we can help you figure out who in your community offers those services.
You're also involved with the Family Nurturing Center. How does this work?
That is a network of parenting education classes in Louisiana. So they range from short hour and a half parenting workshops, some on setting rules, some on morals and values, some on alternatives to discipline, on communicating with respect with your children, and all the way to a 16-week really intensive program that we do with children who are involved in the child welfare system already.
And for those who'd like more information about Prevent Child Abuse Louisiana,
www.pcal.org or KidLine 1-800-CHILDREN.
KidLine 1-800-CHILDREN. Quickly, Stewards of Children.
Stewards of Children is a child sexual abuse prevention program, and it really, the burden lies with adults to keep kids safe from child sexual abuse. So it's a workshop that really shows you how to be aware of the environments that your kids are in and make sure that they're not in a situation that they're open to that.
Well, we look forward to longer discussion with you sometime soon, Amanda. This is an important an important discussion topic, and I'm sure it'll be revisited. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we shall return with Donna Dees. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Tonight, there will be four new members of the Manship School of Mass Communication inducted into the Journalism Hall of Fame at LSU. And those names are Edward Jersey Smith, Mona Williams, Ralph Izzard, and Donna Dees. Donna is with us. She graduated from LSU in 1979, began her career in journalism in Shreveport, becoming assistant press secretary to U.S. Senator Russell Long. Over the last 25 years, she's managed publicity and communications for CBS for multiple programs of the CBS-affiliated networks, most recently as vice president of communications for the CBS distribution of Inside Edition, and she's currently co-producing a documentary about the pioneers of the gun violence prevention movement. Donna was perhaps the first to bring wide-scale attention to this movement with the organization of the Million Mom March in Washington in May of 2000. Good morning, Donna Dees.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for having me on.
Well, nice to talk with you, and you have rubbed shoulders with some of the bright lights in the media world, and certainly you, for example, you worked as director of publicity for The Late Show with David Letterman. How long did you do that?
You know, as a mother, I try not to have favorites, so I'm not going to say I had any particular favorite, but that was one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. I started there in 1995. My second daughter had just been born, and I was really torn about going back to work, but I was offered a job for 14 weeks to fill in while someone else was on maternity leave, and I ended up staying through 2001. We publicized stupid pet tricks and stupid human tricks. We came to New Orleans and flew a whole audience back from New Orleans to be in the audience. It was just a fabulous job.
Is Letterman a good guy, or is he a jerk?
I love David Letterman because, I want to say, Jim, I stayed on in that job because Letterman personally saw to it that I had a job share situation with the mother who I had replaced while she was on maternity leave. And when she came back, he made it happen that we both had that job. We were the only women in the history of CBS to have a job share, and I don't think we've had one since. So I will always be eternally grateful for David Letterman to appreciate working moms.
And you've worked with CBS for a long time. At one point, director of communications for the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather, as well as 48 Hours. Now, Dan Rather, I like him. I've talked with him. I think he's one of the great journalists of this time or any time, but certainly a controversial person who's lasted in that anchor chair from 1981 until 2005. Was he an interesting man?
Dan was a tough boss, but a kind human being. I loved working for Dan. I got to travel all over the world. I went to summits with global leaders in Moscow and Malta, political conventions. So, you know, I was a girl out of, you know, New Orleans with not a lot of contacts and access. And, you know, my journalism degree at LSU was that entree for me. And, boy, I did see the world with Dan. I left Dan when I was pregnant with my first child. So I knew the travel commitment was so great that I couldn't be there for him. But I did return in 2004 to help him transition out of the anchor chair when he was retiring, and helping in the interim anchor Bob Schieffer. And I might add, working for Bob for the 1 year was like working, you know, for Camelot. So I'm blessed, Jim. I'm a very lucky person, and I look back and none of that would have happened had it not been for LSU J School and the Manship School of Communications.
Rather appeared to be somewhat intense.
Very intense. That's a bit of an understatement. But I have to tell you, he could go into a person's home, someone who is not well connected or of any means, and really interview someone with such compassion and able to really talk to people and understand where they came from, because he came from very meager means, growing up in Texas. So he could be a very, very kind person, particularly with those kinds of interviews. But, you know, when he was interviewing elected officials and global leaders, he was tough, and that was his job.
Well, you worked with Rex Reed as well, a guy who is also an LSU Journalism Hall of Famer, who's been right here in this studio, and really a character. It's hard not to like Rex Reed.
It is very difficult not to like Rex. I said, as a mother, I mean, I love them all. Rex, I was Rex's producer, and it was actually a job I was interested in, but when I heard it was for Rex Reed, you know, there was some camaraderie because he was an LSU graduate, and I thought, let me talk about it. Maybe I would be interested. We just spoke the same language, being from Louisiana, and it was another delight. And I have to say, my job was to actually go to the movies and take notes. Jim, I'm not the richest person in the field, okay, but I have been the luckiest person. They paid me to go to movies and sit there and take notes. Now, Rex would see the films on his own, and we would compare notes to see which clips we would use for the show at the movies with Rex Reed. So, yet again, another great job.
Rex was on this show a couple of years ago, and one guy who didn't like him, by the way, was Frank Sinatra. But his question, if he got in a jam, was, do you sleep in the nude? And he even wrote a book by that title.
Yep. You know, but another person who, you know, I have worked with some very big names, and another, Rex was not a big ego. I mean, I have to say, we have some divas out there in the on-air world, but always a professional and really good at his craft. I mean, he loves films and always was very into the detail about what he liked about this film or that film. So, yes, but he is a character. I miss Rex, and quite honestly, now that we're in the Hall of Fame together, I am going to have to pick up the phone and nudge him for lunch. And I'm thrilled to be in the Hall of Fame with you too, Jim.
Well, thank you. And Rex lives in New York City, as you do. He's in the Dakota. Are you there too?
I'm very near him. I can find him.
The Million Mom March. That's your baby. You started it.
It was my baby.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, I was working for Late Show with David Letterman, and we were on break in the summer of 1999, and I was watching cable news, and there was a shooting at a Granada Hills, California day camp, and the kids were very similar in ages to my children at the time, and quite honestly the same ages as the children who were slaughtered at Newtown. That was my Newtown moment. That was my moment I said, I have to do something. And I called all of my women friends and my professional friends, and everyone had the same concerns. How did this criminally ill man get such easy access to so many weapons? So we decided to march on Washington. And, Jim, I have to tell you, it was a one-page PR plan that I learned when I took a PR class at LSU with Dr. Elsie Abair. I don't know if you've ever had her.
I didn't have her as a teacher, but I knew her well.
The one-page plan, because from that one class, I learned how to think like a journalist and think like a publicist. And I always go back to everyone who wants to go do something, and they've got pages and pages and pages. You can get it down to one page. There's your plan. You know, you can expand on it, but yeah. So we launched it on Labor Day. Because I'm a news person, I knew Labor Day tends to be a slow news day, and I was somewhat surprised that we got all the networks and CNN to come with cameras, and we were 25 moms and said we plan to be 1 million moms by Mother's Day 2000. And, Jim, you know, we came darn close. We had about 750,000 people on the actual mall that Mother's Day. Now, we don't know exactly the number. We think it ranges from 150 to another 250,000 who organize support marches across the country, ranging from Juneau, Alaska, to Jackson, Mississippi. So it was a nationwide call for action on that day almost 15 years ago. It'll be 15 years this Mother's Day.
I don't want to take too much emphasis from your speech tonight when you're inducted officially, but what advice do you give graduates of journalism schools and for those who might be considering a career such as yours?
Well, I do get asked a lot of questions and advice, and I always sort of harken back to that they should go and ask questions. When you meet someone like a Dan Bernay, the voice of LSU, if he's talking to someone's talking to your class, spend some time afterwards and ask questions. What do you do for a living? What specifically, you know, are there internships available? Can I get back to you? Because it is what you know, but it's also who you know. And quite honestly, making those contacts while you're in college is very important. Jim, when we were in college, we didn't have Facebook. So I think it's much easier for college kids today to keep in touch with their friends and colleagues, but they still have to do that old-fashioned, you know, make face-to-face contact. And, you know, I got this advice from somebody so many years ago, I'm not quite sure who told me, but said, you know, if you don't embarrass yourself at least twice a day, you're not really living your life. So I go out there, and, you know, if I've had an easy day and I go to bed and nothing worries me, I'm like, well, I really didn't do anything today. So go out there. Sometimes it is embarrassing. Sometimes you will kind of feel awkward. But you know what? Say that to yourself by the end of the day. Do I embarrass myself twice a day? And not feel bad about it, but know that you actually went out there and took some rest.
Well, congratulations, Donna Dees, and you're a fascinating lady, and it's a well-deserved honor. And let's talk again soon, and see you tonight.
Excellent. Thank you,
Donna.
Jim.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we're joined now by Casey Yoder, who worked in Louisiana for a while as a public relations professional in the labor industry, and she is here to talk about a controversy swirling about the PR director for Walmart. He was fired this week after it was revealed that he had lied about having a college degree, something that, unfortunately, some people do, but David Tozar represented himself as a graduate of the University of Delaware, but in fact had no such degree. And why is Casey commenting? She's commenting because from 2010 to 2012, she worked for the Making Change at Walmart campaign, and she was often a target of the ire of Mr. David Tovar. Now, are you crowing over this development, Casey?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm exactly crowing, but it is an interesting development. And I read the news this week with wow, that guy, huh, interesting. But I will say, you know, I've never spoken to David Tovar or met him or interacted with him in any way. But when you're working on opposite sides of an issue like this, you get to kind of know who the other side's PR people are.
And he didn't like some of the things that you presented. You were obviously adversaries. He has one worldview and you have another. And this is a man who had advanced to the PR director for one of the world's great companies. How does it happen that a guy like this could lie for years and not be caught?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I just think that that's probably reflective of Walmart's larger culture. This is a company that, you know, doesn't do the right thing most of the time and isn't very ethical. And clearly the due diligence wasn't done on his background to make sure that the credentials he said he has, he had.
2975633 for Casey Yoder. Now, I mentioned you worked in Louisiana. You were working with the labor movement here.
I was. That was back in the spring of 2009. I was working as part of the Employee Free Choice Act campaign in Louisiana, and that's how I got to know you, Jim.
Yes, and we have met. You haven't met Mr. Tovar, but he was the vice president of communications, and I might add that tonight one of the inductees for the Manship School is a person with essentially the same title, Mona Williams, who I'm sure knows Mr. David Tovar. And Mona, as we know, did graduate from Louisiana State University. This kind of thing happens, but it's not common. But I would imagine there are a few people out there who don't have degrees, who have been presented as such. And sometimes they do what Mr. Tovar has done. They say, well, really, you know, I didn't lie that much. he says he was close. He says he walked with his class, and he was a few hours short, and he got a job, and he went on his way, and he forgot that he didn't have, well, you know. Is there an acceptable explanation for this?
Well, I don't think so. I think the first thing that I learned in journalism school, and probably the first thing you learned in journalism school, is don't lie. And, you know, the lie is often worse than telling the truth. You know, the cover-up is always, always worse. And then you have to apologize for it and try to backpedal and explain, why did you lie to begin with? As a spokesperson, my philosophy has always been that I should never become the story. And when you lie, you open yourself up to becoming the story and taking the focus off what's really important.
And the way he got caught was that he was about to be promoted. And so Walmart, in an abundance of caution, did more close research on him and found out that he didn't graduate from the University of Delaware. And by the way, he didn't say he had a degree in biology or some rigorous field. He said he had a degree in art, and no offense to those who have art degrees, but that's kind of like majoring in journalism. It's probably a little easier to get a degree in art or journalism than it is for one of the other sciences. But nonetheless, he didn't have a degree, and now he's going to be out of a job. Is this too harsh?
I don't think so. I think that as any person who's ever worked in PR or been a spokesperson knows, most of what you have to go on is your word and your credibility. And the moment that that's compromised, you're no longer an effective spokesperson. You no longer have the trust of the public or of the reporters that you're working with.
Well, here in Louisiana, there's an exceptional sportscaster. I've known him for over 30 years, Tim Brando. He worked 15 years for CBS, and I would look on the website, and it said radio television degree, 1978, radio television management from NLU, and I know Tim well enough to know he only went to school there for 1 year. And yet it said that on the CBS website, and Dan Rather, the aforementioned anchor, was fired for much less than this. I'm sure Tim didn't convey this, but somehow, some way, it got to the point where it was on his resume, and he didn't correct it, and he worked at CBS for 15 years. But I would imagine there are many people out there who don't have degrees who are in great positions. For example, Brian Williams, I don't think he has a degree, but he never said he had one. Is that the standard? It's okay to succeed without having a degree, but if you lie about it, you're out.
I think so. I absolutely think there are wonderful people who have very successful careers in the communications field who don't have degrees because they learned on the job, they had maybe some good instincts, and they were able to build on that. And I don't think that the degree necessarily should be a barrier to entry, but I do think that you need to be honest about the fact of whether you have a degree or not, just like you'd be honest about whether or not you actually held this position or held that position or any other job.
297-5633. We'll spend a little more time with Casey Yoder. She is a public relations specialist, and she was on Walmart's one-yard line for a couple of years, and she is commenting on the Vice President of Corporate Communications, David Tovar of Walmart, being canned this week because he misinformed people about having a college degree. Remember George O'Leary, the guy who was in line? He had been hired at Notre Dame as a head coach. He lied about having a master's degree, and he was gone. Is this appropriate? We'll talk more with Casey and also hear from the author Thomas Cade. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. A few more minutes with Casey Yoder, who is a public relations specialist. She worked in Louisiana with the labor movement here, and for 2 years she was involved in scrutinizing the practices at Walmart. And one of her targets was the communications director, target by virtue of just being there with Walmart, David Tovar, who resigned this week after it was revealed that he left the University of Delaware, where he had been studying art, on May 25, 1996, with no diploma. And Walmart says, see you later, David Tovar. Now, earlier you took some shots at Walmart. You don't like Walmart, but obviously a lot of people do. That's why the company has succeeded. Why do you think that this company is such a problem in our society?
Well, Walmart is the largest retailer, the largest company, and the largest employer in this country, and it's the largest retailer in the world. So when you're the biggest, you kind of have a responsibility to try and be the best. And I think Walmart is very good at some of the making money sides of things, but definitely is not good in terms of the labor side of things and how they treat the people who work in their stores, in their supply chains, the people who drive trucks to deliver their materials, et cetera. So that's really the focus of what I did for 2 years when I was on the Making Change at Walmart campaign, was bringing attention to some of these practices that the company had.
Andrew on Highland. Andrew, good morning.
Hey, I don't know if you brought this up as an example, but one successful person in the broadcast business was Peter Jennings, and he didn't go to college.
No, I think he went to college. He just didn't graduate, and he was fabulously successful. And a listener notes that Rush Hudson Limbaugh III flunked out of Southeast Missouri State University. He's done pretty well. 8 years, $400 million. That's not bad, Casey.
Well, no, he certainly has been made more money than I have so far. But, that's like I said earlier. I don't think the problem is having a degree or not having a degree. I think the problem is lying about who you really are and what you've really done.
Well, I mean, when you're a journalist and you lie about yourself, you really don't have a whole lot of credibility when you're reporting on other people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that the flip side for those like me who work talking to reporters, we lose our credibility with you when we lie.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Casey Yoder. Hi, Dan.
Yes. Is it true that one of Walmart's policies is that they have employees, when they're hired on, sign a document agreeing not to work overtime unless it's authorized? And then an employee comes up to his 40 hours, goes to his boss, says, hey, I've got to get authorized. And the boss says, oh, sorry, my boss won't let us have it. But, hey, that inventory's got to get out. So they have employees working for free for this huge, richest employer.
Dan, by the way, is a labor lawyer and a good one. And he doesn't sound real bullish about Walmart.
Well, I certainly can't comment on exactly what Walmart is up to at this exact point in time because I'm not currently working for the Making Change at Walmart campaign. But I definitely heard time and time again from the Walmart associates I talked to and met with over my 2 years between 2010 and 2012 that those were the types of labor practices that they experienced in the stores that they worked in. And I worked with Walmart associates all over the country, from Washington State down to Florida to Texas to California to Maryland. And there were just so many common themes of that, of being asked to work off the clock, to not being allowed to get enough hours to try and support their family.
All right. Well, it doesn't sound like you're crying over the embarrassment that this great company is having over Mr. David Tovar.
Well, I'm not crying, no. I just think that this maybe can be a wake-up call that they need to really look at their hiring policies and practices and from the top to the bottom.
All right. Well, I've been a stockholder in Walmart, albeit a very small one, for many years, and the stock has done well for me. Does that make me a scumbag?
No, I don't think so. I don't think owning stock in Walmart or shopping at Walmart makes you a scumbag. I think that it's all of our responsibilities to try and hold Walmart accountable and point out where they're not doing so well and where they should do better and be more responsible.
Well, I'm sure that you will be watching them with vigilance. And John Ed Bradley, the world-class writer from LSU, he wrote a book several years ago, a novel about Walmart, one of the best pieces ever written about Walmart, although it's not Walmart in the book, called Smoke. And it is a company that, of course, has become one of the world's great companies as far as revenue, right there with the biggies like Apple and Exxon. As far as market value, they are a juggernaut that will not go away. And I think somehow, some way, Casey Yoder, Walmart will survive this embarrassment of David Tovar.
I think so, too.
All right. Well, thank you. And it's good to talk with you. Let's do so again soon. Casey Yoder, who was one of the last official spokespeople for the labor movement in Louisiana. Talk about something that has gone away. There isn't a lot of action on that front in our state, and there is on the business front, but not on the labor side. And I'm sure you have some regret about that.
Well, you know, I am not originally from Louisiana, and I was there on a short-term assignment, but I did see that there's definitely a need for, you know, more attention to the labor movement and workers in Louisiana.
Well, Casey, we'll call you. I think you're back in Atlanta now, if I'm correct.
I am. I'm back in my hometown.
Well, good for you, and let's talk soon.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye. Now we're joined by Thomas Cahill, one of America's exceptional writers, born in New York City, American scholar, and this is a man who is a smart guy. He studied Greek and Latin literature and medieval philosophy, scripture, and theology at Fordham, completed his B.A. in classical literature and philosophy in 1964, went on to complete an M.F.A. in film and dramatic literature at Columbia. And he has written about our world and the world of many centuries ago. And his latest is Heretics and Heroes, How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to visit with you. And when we go back to the late 1400s, early 1500s,
which is a long way from Walmart.
A long way from Walmart. You're right about that. Michelangelo and Walmart are usually not mentioned in the same sentence, but I just did it. But some of the great art of all time was produced during that period. Why was that period so exceptional?
Well, it's not easy to answer the question you just asked. I think that, of course, it comes out of Italy. It really is an Italian phenomenon. In fact, when you come right down to it, it's a phenomenon that, to begin with, is almost wholly associated with the city of Florence, which is an extraordinary place, not very like anywhere else, and I think that's part of it. There's also, I think, a long, long history in Italy of devotion to beauty and pleasure. And those are the two values that are really central to the artistic renaissance of this period. With, you know, if you're not really devoted to beauty and you're not really enticed by pleasure, you will never create the kind of society that Renaissance Italy managed to create in this period. At the same time, just across the Alps, you have the beginnings of the Reformation, a very, very different sort of thing with a very different spirit. The Germans, just on the other side of the Alps, were not so devoted to beauty and pleasure as they were to duty and getting things right, and saying them right, and calling a spade. And those values are the beginning of the Reformation.
Well, the artist that I mentioned, Michelangelo, he may be the gold standard, but there were many others during that period, not just him. At the same,
yeah, he is the gold standard, but and you're absolutely right. It's so fruitful. There are so, you know, to put them into a book, the Heretics and Heroes is, after all, history. It's not an art book. At the same time, I knew that we can't do a book like this without showing some of the art, and that really became a kind of challenge, because so many books like mine, even if they have a few little pieces of art, they're not very well produced. And I was determined to get a beautiful book because, it really, otherwise you're not really valuing and honoring the Renaissance. You're doing the opposite. So I have to say that my publishers went along with it and put in the kind of financing that makes for a beautiful art book,
mm-hmm.
and where you can really see what this is all about and why it was so fantastic.
Well, independent of Michelangelo, who were some of your favorites from
right after him, I think, comes Leonardo. He's not quite at the peak with Michelangelo. Michelangelo was really it, but Leonardo was incredibly diverse, talented, almost divinely talented man. Another was Botticelli. Botticelli is the one who really brings the female body and female centrality into his art in a way that Michelangelo and Leonardo could not have done. And then I think my own personal favorite is Caravaggio. Caravaggio was ignored for a long time because he's so strange, or he was so strange within the context of the this Renaissance period. At the same time, what he was doing was taking it all in the direction of realism, so that his Madonna and Child look like some girl and her little baby from a back street. There's nothing celestial about them. They are very, very earthy and earthly.
Uh-huh.
And Caravaggio is just he's just wonderful, I think, and he has a great sense of humor. He brings into his art all sorts of weird little things that are part of his era and just stuff that he noticed.
Well, you're an Irish American, but you have this great reverence for these Italian artists from the Renaissance. How did this develop with you as an individual?
I've always loved art, and even as a little kid growing up in the Bronx, I got my mother to let me get on the subway by myself when I was 7 years old and go down to the museum, to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, just to look at the paintings. So it's been a long journey, I suppose, but she let me do it. You couldn't do that with a kid today. The world has become far too dangerous. All she needed to do was make sure that I knew how to read a subway map, so if I got lost, I could find my way again. But I wouldn't let a seven-year-old go from the Bronx to
You were seven.
Manhattan. Yeah.
Wow, that is great. I love that.
But, you know, this is 1947 also, so it's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Heretics and Heroes. The Dallas Morning News says Thomas Cahill is our king of popular historians, eminently learned and wise. He's also the author of How the Irish Saved Civilization. You have a chapter at the end of your book, Human Love, How to Live on This Earth. What's past is prologue, is the quote from The Tempest. You have some appreciation of what happened during the time you're writing about in Heretics and Heroes and how that is applicable to today.
Well, you know, the Reformation was a catalyst for many things. And, of course, it was a division in Europe in Western Europe of two kinds of Christianity. You would say, well, you know, they're both Christianity. What's the big problem? As we would probably say today about Muslims killing one another in enormous numbers, we would say, what's the problem? They're both Muslims, aren't they? Can't they figure it out? In the 17th century, you have these terrible battles, horrible, bloody things in which all the Catholics are trying to kill all the Protestants, and all the Protestants are trying to kill all the Catholics. And it is very like what is going on today in the Middle East between Sunni and Shia. And we look at it and we kind of shake our heads, but we ought to remember that go back seven centuries and you'd find us in the same position. So it takes a long time for people to build up enough respect for one another that they can say, you know, I don't agree with you, but, you know, live your life, be happy, rather than, I don't agree with you, I'm going to kill you if I can. It really is, you have something at the end of this period called the 30 Years' War, and it's just horrible. But at the same time, and that's why I put in this, how to live on this earth, human love, how to live on this earth, that you have the beginnings of people saying, no, I'm not doing it that way. I'm not entering into this kind of crazy controversy that ends in blood.
The book is Heretics and Heroes from the eminent historian Thomas Cahill. Thank you, Thomas. We'll be back Monday. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.